Good morning. Take me back in that picture. I think I gained a few pounds since then. I don't know, but I feel like I'm standing on holy ground. I got to tell you, the prayers and the tears of the pastors and the leadership and the testimony, I mean, we could all probably go home right now. The Spirit of the Lord is here. And not just today, not just this church. I don't know if you realize how significant this church is, not only in the city of Denver, but really nationally. And I am just floored. I'm so thankful for and proud of and just in awe of what Jason and Jen and Juan and Courtney and Josh and Katie and those of you who have been here these 17 years and what has been accomplished for the sake of the gospel and the glory of God. You need to realize your church is just really part of a tip of a spear of a 100-year movement in this country. And that movement is to bring diverse people together through the power of the Holy Spirit, men and women of diverse ethnic and economic backgrounds, willing themselves to walk and to work and to worship God together as one in a local church to express a credible gospel beyond what Jason was talking about, not words, not just words, but actually the demonstration of the power of Jesus to be lifted up and draw all people, not just some people, to himself. And not just some people who look like you and think like you and act like you. You know, Christ died like this, right? He didn't drop the Republicans for the Democrats. He didn't drop, right, the blacks for the whites. Or you see what I'm saying? He holds everyone in tension. And that's where the unity is, in this tension. I don't speak Spanish. I'm around it a lot. I understand more than I probably give off. But many of you, like me, you probably didn't understand the prayer in Spanish, did you? With your mind. But you understood it, didn't you? That the God that we serve, the God who loves us, that we sing about, he's the God of all people, not just some. Your way is a way to do things, not the way to do things. And he is so big and so powerful. You're just thankful you got a seat at the table. Amen. Amen. So all to say, this is a very unique and special church, part, again, of a tip of a spear of a 100-year movement in this country. And that is, again, to build what we would call healthy, multi-ethnic, economically diverse, socially just, culturally intelligent, and ultimately financially sustainable churches in this country, again, to declare a credible gospel on earth as it is in heaven. You know, Christ taught us to pray, right? Thy kingdom come, thy will be done where? On earth as it is in heaven. But since 1997, I've been asking myself and trying to address the question, if the kingdom of heaven is not segregated, then why on earth is the church? And your church, again, a tip of the spear of this movement. By the way, it's very interesting that entire epochs of church history, hundreds of years later, are addressed in a single word. In other words, if we look back on the fourth century today, and I say to you, particularly at a seminary, pastors, theologians, people that think about these things, and I say, what is the single greatest movement? What is the single greatest move of the Holy Spirit in the fourth century to advance the church and advance the gospel of Jesus? And it's one word, and it's a man's name, Constantine. It was the conversion of the Roman King Constantine who advanced the church. That had more to do with the advance of the church and the gospel than anything else in a 100-year period called the fourth century. If I say to you the 16th century, maybe you'd know. You know what the word is? Reformation. And that one word sums up 100 years of people's lives and interaction and everything to advance God. If God tarries and it's 2500 A.D., and people look back on this century, what will be that word? Well, I don't know what the word is. I'm not a prophet in that sense, but I have no doubt it's what you all are expressing, and again, amongst very few in America, and that is multi-ethnic, economically diverse, just, etc. Why? Because, as Jason said, if the gospel was a product that we sold, right? If the gospel is something you sold, like a product, like an iPhone, no one will buy it in the next 30, 40 years. It's already undersold. Why? Because you cannot keep preaching and telling people God loves everyone from segregated pulpits and pews. The message is unbelievable. And that's not going to happen. See, God, we're on a trajectory to Revelation 7, 9. Whether you understand it or not, we're all going there. It's like the universe expanding. We're going there. And that's why in this century, God will not let that happen. And so I know Jason and Juan and others, Katie and us and others like at this conference, we are all collectively tip of the spear in trying to help churches move away from explanation without demonstration, again, for the glory of God. You're doing that, and I'm just blown away. So congratulations. Thank you. But this is a significant work. And as you've seen, it doesn't take thousands of people to have significant work. And this demonstrates the power of unity to impact an entire city and an entire nation coming out of this church right here. So it truly is an honor. I feel like I'm on holy ground, and thank you so much for having me. You're in this series called Firm Foundations, and of course, all the leaders here don't want to talk to you about money, so they picked me to come and talk to you about money, right? Just kidding. But all to say, I want to elevate our conversation here in the next 30 minutes or so. And give you a snapshot of what I know to be true about the American church when it comes to stagnation and decline, and to kind of understand the era in which we live. So I really want to go up to 30,000 feet and give you that view, and we'll kind of land the plane and have some thoughts for you at the end. Because the fact is, the foundation of the American church is extremely shaky. It's not firm. It's shaky. Extreme. And I want to talk about why that is. And of course, in the context of missional vibrancy and financial sustainability. So in 1 Chronicles chapter 12 and verse 32, we read, "And from Issachar, one of the 12 tribes of Israel, men who understood," and by the way, later it's their families too, so men and women, "who understood the times and knew what Israel should do." Men who understood the time from the tribe of Israel and knew what Israel should do. Now, there's at least three things happening in that passage, right? First of all, people paused and called a timeout to think deeply about their current situation. In other words, they just didn't perpetuate and expect that what has always been will always be, right? They called a timeout because to understand something, you got to take a step back and give it some thought. Number two, in their thinking, they recognized that their time, their moment, was significantly different than the past. They're in a moment in the present, and they're looking to where is this thing going in the future, right? So they understood, they paused to think deeply, they recognized their time was different than times past and times to come, and therefore they were able to discern what was the best course of action for the nation of Israel to take in the moment, as they didn't just play for today, but they began to position the nation for tomorrow. And all of that is what I'm inviting you in the next few minutes with me to do, is take a step back. Let's think deeply about the shaky foundation of the American church, why that is, how it affects us today, and how we should think about positioning ourselves for tomorrow. It's my contention, and I get around, I'm like the guy on, what's that commercial? You know, I know a thing or two because I've seen a thing or two, right? I've been in full-time ministry 42 years, 18 as a student ministries pastor, and then doing what the folks here did, Jason, Juan, and others, starting a multi-ethnic church in the inner city of Little Rock, Arkansas, in 2001. So I've been in ministry 42 years, and I do get around, and I know a few people, et cetera. And it's my contention and my firm belief that most pastors and churches in America today, in spite of their good hearts, in spite of their good intentions and their hustle and their effort, are merely managing the stagnation, if not the inevitable decline of their churches. They're not going like this, they're going like this. They're this and going like this, even though they don't know it. They're trying, they're hustling, you see? But that's the net effect of all that. And if I had more time with you, I'd talk to you about why that is. In part, that's because the American church is still chasing 20th century metrics now 25 years into the 21st century. In other words, the scorecard is rooted in 1960 and 1970 and 1980. And pastors want to achieve these goals, but they're all rooted 50 years ago. And I don't know if you know what my wife years ago, she said, "You ever look up what happens to you if you don't update an operating system, like for a smartphone or a computer?" I never had. I looked it up. It'll preach, you guys, like Jason and others. It'll preach because there's all these bad things that happen or can happen. Like, for instance, you're more of a security risk. Your computer can get hacked. It can't communicate. Just yesterday, Hunter, somebody showed me that last week. I held my iPhone up to Hunter's, and we traded information. But you can't do that if you don't have the latest operating system, right? And there's all these different things. It runs slower. And so all to say is that's the American church. Our operating system is 20th century. Which, as Jason said, it's rooted in explanation, not demonstration, among other things. It's rooted in size. What defines a good church is how big it is. First of all, that's not even biblical. And secondly, that's not what defines in the 21st century. It's not about size. It's about influence. And the greater your diversity, assuming structural health like you have, the greater your influence in a community. I mean, you're living examples of that. I bet there's churches 10 times your size in the city that do like 1% of the work that you do in this city. On and on it could go. So all to say, most pastors and churches at the American level are just managing the stagnation, if not the decline of their churches, chasing 20th century metrics. And one of those metrics is still believing that tithes and offerings, the giving of its members, is enough to not only pay the bills, but to have cross purpose and do all these different things. And that is not true. In the 21st century, you have to create multiple streams of income. But most churches are still depending on tithes and offerings. So anecdotally then, here's the problem. At best, tithes and offerings, the giving of members, all y'all, I'm going to say, let's say you're members of this church. Let's say I'm your pastor and I encourage you to give. And you give consistently, faithfully, generously. Those are called tithes and offerings, right? It's a way of saying the giving of your members. And anecdotally, tithes and offerings at best today are just paying the bills of a church. What are the bills? The salaries of the staff, the light, this space, heat and air, right? The basics of the bills. You might call it a general fund. But at best, the giving of local churches and their members is just paying the bills. You don't have money to engage the immigrant. I'm not saying you. I'm giving you come up to, you know, 30,000 feet. But churches don't have money to engage the immigrant. They don't have money to engage those who are poor or aging out of the foster care system or at-risk children in the community. They don't have it because all of the money is just taking care of the basic church bills, what it takes to operate a church, right? And they have a little bit of money, so they send $100 over here and they send $200 over here and one person volunteers over here, right? And God bless all that, okay, but it's not having a significant impact. And by the way, the pastor's saying, oh, yeah, we do this, we do that, we do that. No, you don't. You send $100 here, and and one person in your church does this, and you say, we do it. No, you don't, because you don't have the money to do it, let alone the imagination, et cetera, to do it. And that is the condition of most churches in America. So that's the problem. The question becomes, how can we, that is a local church, how can it scale its missional vibrancy, its kingdom work in the community, and pursue financial sustainability? So the idea of scaling kingdom work is cross-purpose. Just think cross-purpose. Way beyond what this church can afford, that's what you've done. Am I right? How did you do that? How was that done? It scaled kingdom work. It advanced what I call missional vibrancy, beyond what a church could otherwise do with its money, with its people. A church of a couple hundred here, let's say this morning, how are you going to do all that? You can't, right? From a human perspective, based on tithes and offerings, the human resource, et cetera, and in the process help to ensure that you're going to be here for 50 years or 80 years and not just for 5. So that's the question then, given what I've said. Now, I've written a couple books on this, as Hunter mentioned. The first one, Disruption, Repurposing the Church to Redeem the Community. And I talk about, you know, this is an example in that book. Wherever I go, I'm always talking about Providence Bible and cross purpose, because again, it's a tip of the spear. So y'all are in that book. But also then in 2019, I followed that up with The Coming Revolution in Church Economics, the subtitle, Why Tithes and Offerings Are No Longer Enough and What You Can Do About It. Now, church economics defined then is how do we leverage the assets of a church, which essentially are the people, its money, and its facilities. And I could go deeper on that. There's more nuance to that. But for sake of time, I won't. How do we leverage the assets of a church to bless the community, just what you're doing? Like, again, think cross-purpose, to advance mission and vision, the kingdom of God, to engage people at the bridge of Christ's humanity not just at the bridge of his divinity. And at the same time, generate sustainable income, right? To get beyond sole dependence on tithes and offerings. See that last phrase? It doesn't say y'all don't give, right? But we can't rely. It's not enough. It's barely enough to pay the bills. So how do we hustle, if you will, in a biblical way in order to advance missional vibrancy and again, to guarantee or generate sustainable income? And I explain all that. Now, from a sociological perspective, remember I'm talking at a 30,000-foot view of the American church and for our country. Why is that? What happened? Because back in 1960, there was this general vibe in America. And it didn't work for all kinds of all households. Like, for instance, I was born out of wedlock, 1961. My mother had an affair with a Russian Jew Italian man. I came out, he realized I wasn't his, off he went to Colombia, and then, they were not married, I should say. And when I came out, I needed a name, because at that time only 5% of kids in America didn't have a dad, and it was a big deal, like stereotypical and no resources for single parent moms. And I learned hustle from my mom. I was selling Avon with her on the streets of Alameda when I was 6, 7 years old, bagging it up, doing the orders. Washing dishes at the Phoenix Playboy Club. I mean, I was sweeping the Circle K. We were hustling family. My mom had 3 jobs just to make it work. She was hustle before hustle was cool, and eBay and all that stuff before it ever was done. So I learned all that intrinsically from growing up in that environment. But I had a lot of friends, and the vast majority of America in that time, not everybody, but the way it was, there was an old show like Ozzie and Harriet, and a man, there was a family, man and a woman, they had a couple kids. The man went to work, this is 1960s, and he got a single paycheck. And he brought that paycheck home. They owned a house, they had a car, they belonged to the country club. Mom stayed home and took care of the kids. Those days are gone, and they're never coming back. And so all to say, what are some of the sociological factors like this driving the need for churches to get beyond sole dependence on tithes and offerings and learn to generate sustainable income by leveraging assets and blessing the community. Rise, growing burden on the middle class, lowest middle class wealth since 1941. In America, what's so significant? The poor don't have money to do anything. The rich are often thinking about themselves. It's the middle class that gets everything done. And we're like this, right? The rise of dual income households, I just was explaining that. In fact, let me ask you, how many of you are in a household where you have at least 2, if not more, income streams? Would you raise your hands and hold them up high? Raise them high. I'm right there with you. Raise them high. Look around the room real quick. That is America today. In 1960, less than 20% of households had 2 or more income streams. Today, it's over 80% and rising. And I didn't realize, Jason, this whole church is so rich. Y'all, look how many hands went up. 2 or more. You must be rich. Are you rich? No, we know that, right? My wife and I have 4 income streams in our life, and to live now at our age, a little bit upper middle class life, we came from lower middle class, I was certainly born in that, but we have 4 more income streams just to pay the bills, take care of our family, live a middle class life, but it used to be like that, as I just explained, so those days are gone, right? There's been a shift in generational approaches and attitudes towards giving. There's declining church attendance and budgets, automation. So pastors are already looking out. I think 40,000 Amazon workers just got laid off due to automation. So I'm going to stand in front of this church. Let's say you're my church, and somebody, man, you got to give more. And 30% of you just lost your job in the last 6 months due to automation. You have to get retrained, reprogrammed, if you will, right? These are the conditions of the American church. But pastors are still living like the tithe, hey, give everybody tithe. Everything's going to be fine. And it's already not. They know it. They just don't know what to do about it. And it's not about, as Jason and I were talking before the service, I'm not interested in helping a pastor maintain his ineffective ministry. You know what I'm saying? Or the ineptitude of that church just to help you pay the bills. No, this is about, again, using you as an example, advancing that missional vibrancy like a cross purpose, having tremendous impact in a community that you can't otherwise have if it's just tithes and offerings and the human resource of the church. So how do pastors normally handle this problem? Well, here's 3 different ways. We got to grow our church. If we can just grow our church, everything will be fine. I'm going to show you in a moment why that's not true, tied to demographic shifts and generational approaches and attitudes towards giving. Pastors will teach financial peace. A guy named Dave Ramsey. We've even had it in our church and taught people. I have never taught it, but some people in our church do it. And, you know, they want to help you understand money and money management and wealth and get out of debt and pay off your bills. And all. Hey, great. All well and good. Let's get out of it. Let's do all that. How about generosity? How many sermons? You know, I played college baseball at a school called Liberty University back when it was 10 years old. And the founder was a man named Dr. Jerry Falwell. And he was very passionate for the cause of pro-life and against abortion. And we had to go to 7 church services a week. That's the truth. And if Dr. Falwell was preaching, it didn't matter what passage in Scripture he was preaching from that night, that passage had to do with abortion and pro-life issues. You know what I'm saying? Like, but that's the way a lot of pastors are, because the money's down here, so they're trying to squeeze blood out of a tournament and couch it in the language of generosity. Oh, we should be generous and we should give, but really they need your money to keep the lights on. So all my point is this: yes, let's grow the church, and sure, let's teach good biblical principles, or maybe what Jason, you said, you're doing something about wealth or understanding debt on Monday nights, and yeah, we should be generous, and we should be giving and tithing and offering, of course. I'm just saying it won't be enough in the 21st century, given the context, men of Issachar who understand this month. That might have worked in the 20th, and it did. It doesn't work in the 21st, and it limits a church's ability to engage people at the bridge of Christ's humanity, to demonstrate the gospel, because they just have enough money to pay the bills. And all of that hurts the credibility of our witness. So, again, without diving too deep, what I advocate and what I had to learn in the inner city, by the way, when I started my church, our church in the inner city in the summer of 2001, I came from an extremely wealthy church. 5,000 white Republican suburbanites, I already said that, white suburban Republican, very wealthy people. Money in that church grew on trees. I could tell you how very wealthy that church was and remains to this day. And the more people that joined that church, we made money. In fact, I sat in an elders meeting one time where they were calculating the next year's budget. And they had 5 years of history or whatever it was, and they said, we calculate that we're going to grow, I'm making up a number, 479 people next year. And for every person that we grow, they put a dollar amount on the head. Based on history, they said for 475, the average gift is going to be this, it's going to increase our budget this, and that's how they plan their giving. When I went to the inner city of Little Rock, 67% of kids growing up without dads in the home, highest violent crime in the city, poverty extreme, 30% at or below the poverty level. I quickly found out, and I'm planting a multi-ethnic church, by the way, economically diverse, etc. The more people that joined our church, it cost us money. I realize in the inner city, people take money out of the plate. They don't put money in the plate. And I was going to either have this nice little church of 50, 75 people and pay myself and a little secretary and sing and worship and pat myself on the back and go home every night as a do-gooder. Or if we're going to meet the aggressively engage this community need, there is no way the giving of this church can be able to do it. And we had to figure out a system. And so the bottom line is, without going into it, that's not the purpose here. There's 3 ways: tithes and offerings, that's our giving. I'm talking like if this is our church, we are giving, yes, generously, biblically, etc. But we have to develop grants and donations like you've done with CrossPurpose. Think about what CrossPurpose has done in terms of being able to shift the purpose of CrossPurpose out from under the church and create like a sister in the family. 2 sisters in the same house. But by shifting the purposes of CrossPurpose, most churches, even if they had that vision, they do it under the church. But if you do it under the auspices of a church, you're not going to attract grants from local, state, federal funders, because they see what's called religious affiliation, and likely, in most cases, they're not going to fund it. Nor do you attract donations from people in the community, Christian or not. They believe in what CrossPurpose, they give. I don't know the books, but I have no doubt there are people in this city that don't believe in Jesus, that don't go to a church, but are heavily engaged, whether financially, human resource, in one way or another, in the great work that CrossPurpose did. This church started that, like 2 sisters in the same house. And the grants and donations help in the overall financial health so that we can scale the missional vibrancy and position ourselves for long-term sustainability. And the last is for-profit return on investment. The simplest way for a church to make money, for instance, is to rent its building. It took us 15 years to own a building, and it took 10 years until earlier this year for us to achieve a goal that I've had for 10 years, in part buying that building. Our mortgage is $22,000 a month, and now we net $22,000 in rental income along with our event center. We have a medical clinic. We have John Brown University Counseling Clinic. We have multiple nonprofits. We have like a what you might call a Planet Fitness rents from us. And the income, pure ROI, just by renting the building is $22,000 a month, and that's our mortgage. And if you are my church, that's why I can say to you, not one penny of what you put into an offering plate to give to the Lord and expand his work is going to a bank, because we know how to hustle and we know how to steward our assets. So these are three big buckets that it requires for a church not just to survive or even be stable, but long-term sustainable and scale missional vibrancy in the 21st century. But again, most pastors are still playing just on the tithes and offerings game. That's like a football team that only fields an offense. It has no defense. It has no special teams. Do you think that team is going to win? That's why the American church isn't winning on a variety of fronts, and we're just talking money this morning. One other thing, though, I want to show you is that there's a rapidly changing population and demographic, right? So today, 50% of Gen Z is non-white, 43% of millennials are non-white. By 2042, one in two people in America are not white, et cetera, et cetera. And aging population, less babies, all this. These are changing demographics and populations in America. And given historic income inequality in America, as well as migration, immigration, globalization, this too is affecting the giving of people who attend church. So now it's not just the inner city. When most churches, you go to church, it costs the church money to have you or take. See, so let me show you what that means. During the pandemic, I was hired to help out a church 6 hours away. I became kind of the senior pastor for 14 months of a church. I was still doing everything I do, but it's like called fractional. So I was helping this church. 10-acre campus, two gyms. It was at one time the Willow Creek of its city, Columbia, Missouri, 2,500 people. It was blowing and going. It had two gyms, 10-acre campus, as I just mentioned. And by the time I got there, it had stalled and was in big time decline over 7 years, as you'll see in a moment. Now, when I got there, the budget, the monthly need was $112,000. You see $100,000 fixed cost. The average offering was $93,500. That means every offering was $18,500 short, or the monthly was $18,500 short of what they needed. When I got there, they were losing $35,000 a month. They had just under $500,000 in the bank, and I calculated that that church, if nothing changed, they had 19 months to live. When I got there, the attendance was 224 people. When I finished there, or a month before I finished, we were up to 397. That's 173 people gained. Pretty good, don't you think? Short amount. Hey, we grew 170. I'm feeling pretty good right now, right? Now, check this out. During that same time, roughly the same time, 76 what's called giving units. That means 76. Like, I'm looking at y'all. Let's say it's a household. Look at a beautiful new baby there, right? This is a household. And if they give a check consistent, maybe monthly or weekly, whatever, that's called a giving unit. So even though there's two, they give one from their household. And so people that study this call that a giving unit, okay? This church lost 76 giving units in the time I was there. It takes time for people to give once they start coming to church. And when they leave a church, it takes people time to kind of finish their giving. That's the nice way of saying they didn't like me and they left. Okay, so joke for all four of you still awake on this through time. But we gained 68. Now, see, it's very close. So when we're thinking about money and sustainability, we're pretty close. We ought to be doing all right. We gained 173 people. We actually gained 68 givers in spite of 76. So we should be pretty good, right? Take a look. I asked the bookkeeper. She'd been there 18 years. I said, I know you don't keep demographic information, black, white, Asian, Hispanic, who's old, who's young, who gives. But I want you to do the best you can and give me an estimate based on your 18 years experience of two things, the diversity in terms of ethnicity or culture and age, generational. And here's what she said. Of the 76 lost, three were in their 30s and the rest were 40 plus. And no one, zero people of color. They basically were all white. Of the 68 gained, 9 were between the ages of 20 and 39. The rest were 40 plus, and 8, she said, were African Americans. And you see my influence. Do you understand? Growing the church younger, growing the church more like the kingdom of heaven, reflect the community. Now, take a look at what this meant. Of the 76 that were lost, almost $42,000 of monthly giving went out the door. But of the 68 gained, it only netted about $5,500. You see the difference? $36,000 a month. The older and white, as it leaves, younger and diverse cannot replace that on a one-to-one ratio. And most pastors think it can, because that's how it used to work in the 20th century. In other words, if take a look here. The average gift of those 76 older white people was $571 a month. The average gift of the younger, more diverse crowd was $70 a month. And that meant in this particular church that for every giving unit that left, you needed 6.87 giving units to just equal that giving. Say 1 to 7. And you already saw we gained 173 to get the 68. What does it cost you to get a 65-year-old person to come to your church? Nothing. Now, sure, there's lights and salaries and all, but I'm talking about programming costs. You say, we got a Sunday school class for people your age. They'll be there. What does it cost to get a millennial family, 30, 31, 32 years of age, with 3 kids under 5 to come to your church? You better have security, the best programming, the right teacher ratios, and all of that costs money. And what pastors and churches don't understand, they're looking at a budget in this moment thinking if we could just grow, we'll be fine. But what you're not realizing is that as you grow, it's going to cost you more money. And all that's to say is that churches and pastors are like hamsters on a wheel chasing growth, thinking they're going to take care of the problem. So again, I wanted to take you up to 30,000 feet on this. And the key point is we as Congregation America have to get beyond 20th century thinking and realize, yes, tithes and offerings, but also nonprofit work for the reasons you do it, grants and donations, and for-profit income leveraging assets. Now, if I say that to people, maybe pretend I'm your pastor, I'm trying to share, hey, we got to develop multiple streams of income and generate ROI and grants. And maybe most places around America, they're going to walk up to you, Pastor, where's your faith? Just preach the gospel and God will supply all your needs in Christ Jesus, right? Maybe you're thinking that right now. What is all this business stuff? And just preach the gospel. Trust God, right? How do you respond to that? I know how I respond. I say, let me ask you a question. Have you ever taken a loan to buy a car you couldn't afford? Have you ever taken a loan to buy a house you couldn't afford, send your kid to college? Well, where's your faith? Right? Do you work hard? Do you get a job? Do you try to get advanced? Maybe like you try to get a raise, you grow in the company, responsibility, you take care of your family, you're always looking for more money, right? Where's your faith? Why don't you just sit in your house all day, pray, read the Bible, and once a week go to your mailbox and look for a check? You don't live like that. You see what I'm saying? The individual, you don't separate, Christians don't separate their intentionality when it comes to money with not trusting God. But somehow, when it comes to the church, they want to say, just trust God. How do people get saved? Can God send dreams and visions? Yes. Does he do it? I'm sure he does. I've met a few people in time. They never, you see? But what is the primary way that our sovereign God said, let's do this with me and you? He said, I'll do the heavy lifting, but you go and tell. And he creates a partnership. And he doesn't, our intentionality to share the gospel doesn't take away anything from his sovereignty. You plan a worship service, you plan discipleship, you plan evangelism, but somehow we're not going to be intentional when it comes to diversity or economics. That's a problem. Somebody's going to push back theologically and they'll say, man, wait now. We can't make money in this church. We can't get into all that because Jesus overturned the money changers. Right? But that's a lack of understanding of what was going on. He called it a den of robbers and thieves for a reason. And there were two reasons. One, the money changers and the merchants. People carried Roman coinage, but to get into the temple, you had to buy a ticket. And to buy a ticket, it cost you a half shekel. That's a Jewish coin. And so you had to convert your Roman coin to a Jewish half shekel on the spot. Have you ever been in a foreign country, maybe Europe, you had euros, and you forgot to exchange them at a bank in country, so you end up at the airport and you have to pay what? A higher interest rate. That doesn't hurt you if you have money, but it hurts the poor. Same thing with the merchants. They're selling turtle doves. They're selling bulls and rams and lambs. And you see what I'm saying? For sacrifice. And you're coming from 30 miles away over a period of days and dusty roads and people on the road. You're not dragging a lamb to sacrifice. It could die in the way. You're buying those animals on spot. How much does it cost you for a hot dog at the local football stadium? I don't know, 10 bucks? Right? Why? You're a captive audience. And that's what they were doing with these animals. So this was not at all about fair or just profit. It was about unjust profiteering and hurting, of course, the poor. But finally, how I'd say all this to you, which is starting to land the plane here, this is all about stewardship. And I know you've heard the word stewardship before. We should be good stewards and all that kind of stuff. But let me share with you how the American church and pastors typically define stewardship. They define it in these three ways: tending to and well-managing, I should say, those things that God has given to us. Like, I don't know, we got this building and there's a hole in the wall. You know, I had students, they'd create chaos, they'd knock a hole in the wall, break the glass. We got to repair it. God gave us this asset. We need to take care of it. We need to maintain it, right? Accurately accounting, people give, tithes and offerings. We got to accurately report that, you know, and we have to clearly communicate how we're spending the money. That's why there's a budget and a vote and all that stuff, right? I'm all for that. This is all part of good stewardship, but it's actually a subset of stewardship called management. This is management, a subset of stewardship. You know what stewardship is in the Bible? You gave me five, I made you five. You gave me two, I made you two. One guy sat on his asset. In the South, they get that. I'm not sure about here in Denver. But the guy, five and two, right? Well done, good and faithful steward, right? One guy sat on his asset. He buried it. He was afraid. He didn't want to take a risk. He managed that asset. And the master calls him a wicked, lazy steward. He says, take that one asset away from him. Give it to the guy with 10, because that guy knows what to do with it, right? That wicked, lazy steward, that is the American church. We are a wicked, lazy steward collectively of the resources God has put in our hand. By the way, we steward our minds. We steward our salvation. I got saved. I tell people I multiply the kingdom, right? So stewardship is always about multiplication. But we understand it as management. And again, you wonder why we're not winning. And we have people and we have money, the ability to aggregate money quickly. We have facilities, etc. But we manage them. And we don't leverage them to generate more. Missional vibrancy, kingdom work in the community, demonstrating the gospel, and financial resources to keep us here for decades to come, right? The American church defines stewardship as management. And what does that look like? We are wicked, lazy stewards. We are literally sitting on billions and billions of dollars of assets buried in the ground. It's a church that owns land. It's owned that land, 5 acres, 10 acres, 20, for 20, 25 years, and it's done absolutely nothing with it. It's a church, 65 people in a Methodist church I know, $2.5 million in the bank, nobody's getting saved, the community is not being engaged, but by golly, they are so proud to tell you, to a person, they have $2.5 million in the bank. It's churches all over this country that were built for Sunday, not Monday to Saturday. And those buildings sit empty from Monday to Saturday, doing absolutely nothing for the kingdom, for the community. Wicked, lazy stewardship. That's a snapshot of the American church. And you're not there. I want to be clear. You're on this journey. At 17 years old, my colleague Harry, who's our senior pastor, he thinks churches are, you know, they go through kind of a life cycle before you have to reinvent and have kids and grandkids. At 17, like, you're in your senior year of high school. Or maybe you've gone to college, you're a freshman, right? You're not married yet, you don't have kids yet, so you're still maturing. At us, we're 24 years old. We kind of feel like we're engaged to someone right now, but we're still not married, but we're engaged. You see, because we're all on a journey of maturity. It's not like you're good, bad. It's about maturing. But when you stagnate that maturity, you don't grow, then you stagnate and ultimately decline. So all to say that stewardship is ultimately about leveraging assets, generating more, doing more in a variety of kingdom work, salvations and economics or financial sustainability, so we can be doing cross-purpose this church for decades to come and not otherwise just managing this into decline. So to land the plane with y'all, how about you? Let me ask you a question and bring it home. How many of you pay the bills in your household? You're the one, hold your hands up high, you write the checks, you watch the bills. Okay, I got three questions for you. Do you ever face rising costs for goods and services, maintenance that you didn't expect? I don't know, the gas company raised its prices 20%. You ever face that? Yes or no? Give me a verbal. Yes. Yeah, okay, how about this? Unexpected repairs or replacements, your dishwasher went out, your HVAC system, it just went out, and you didn't expect it, but you got to replace it because you need that air, right? How many, you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
All right, how about this one? Do you have some desired improvements? Some aspirational goals. Man, this carpet's like 20 years old. I'd love to replace the carpet. Or if we could just redo our bathroom, it'll jack up the equity in our house and we can enjoy it more. You guys have some aspirational goals for desired improvement? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yeah? Well, what I got news for you is this. So does this church. You're always looking for more money. Not just the money you have doing everything. You got these three issues. Costs go up. Unexpected repairs and replacements. You have some desire. This church, like any church, is also a household. And just like you never have enough money to get it all done, neither does this church, right? Because the people who take care of this household, the people that pay the bills of this household, they face all those same things. They got the budget, but then rising costs for goods and services. Unexpected repairs and replacements, a desire to go bigger and to improve. You see what I'm saying? And the people that manage this household, like you manage yours, they got all these same issues, right? And you need to understand that. We need to understand that as people in a church, that is true too. And that's why I can look you in the eye and say, this church is never going to stop asking you for money, ever. Just like in your household, you need more money, this household is always going to need money. But the smart play that this church is doing is not just depending on the tithes and offerings of its members. It's developing the grant donation side. We're talking about the for-profit side. And that takes a burden off the body. Because if I'm your pastor and I'm squeezing everything I can get out of you and I don't have imagination for these other things and understand the 21st century is different than the 20th, then I'm going to put all that pressure on you. Right? To keep this thing alive and keep going. But by playing this game, moving from just an offense to a defense special teams, yes, we have a part to play. But so does the hustle of your leadership. And these leaders hustle, I can tell you that, in this church. So all to say, as in your own household, there's always going to be a need for more money in the household of God. And your part is one of the parts. And that part is being generous, tithes and offerings, faithful and consistent, etc., as the Lord leads you. So while leaders here, just like in my own church, like if I was your pastor, I can't promise you we're never going to talk to you about money and giving. We're going to talk about it pretty regularly always because it's biblical, it's right, and it's a part of the missional vibrancy and sustainability of the church. But what they can promise you is that they will always be, as they've always been, because I know these guys from years past, open and approachable, honest and accountable, thoughtful and resourceful, faithful and hopeful, when it comes to money. So in our church, from the very beginning, I'll close with this, we have always understood and told our folks, if we do what we can for ourselves, we believe God will do for us what we can. And that's rooted in a passage that my wife and I founded that church on, faithful is he who calls you, and he will do it. We can't do it all, but we can do what we can, and then we trust God for what we can. And at the same time, we hustle to move away from a single-dimensional game to a three-dimensional game. And all of that is understood here. All of that's in play here, and that's why you got one amazing church. God bless you, and thanks so much for having me today.